The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition. And today, little change up. Jim is not on the show with me. It's going to be the Chris and Jake Q&A show today. So I'll get Jake on here momentarily. I do want to start the show and apologize to those who are, I'll call them avid listeners, who listen immediately after each show is released. The EDU show for this week, we didn't have one. So, we had a sudden issue, actually about a half an hour before Jim and I were due to record that podcast. My daughter started showing signs of what we thought was an appendix issue. And, we had another child years ago who we barely got to the hospital in time with an appendix issue that had to be removed under emergency conditions. So I was a little on the nervous side and decided I better get her to the ER, make sure that everything is okay. So the good news is appendix doesn't appear to be the problem. I guess good and bad news. It's always good to know what the issue was, but we're still looking at it. She's doing much better now, and I think the emergency has certainly passed, and she's home safe at this point. But because of Jim's travel schedule and everything, him heading out of town, we didn't have the ability to get back together to record a show for Wednesday's EDU release. So we'll have an EDU show this coming week, but this was a rare event. Those of you who listen regularly know that we very rarely skip a show, but events transpired that prevented that from happening. So I hope you'll all understand. The Q&A show today, we will be covering fairly typical stuff. Jake, because he's not only a CFP, part of the retirement planning team in our office, he's also an enrolled agent, so has his hands on the tax elements, tax preparation, and a lot of the tax planning that we do here in the firm, alongside a couple of CPAs that we also have that we call our tax team. And so we're going to focus on some tax-related elements here, too, since we've got the opportunity to have Jake on the show. So, Jake, thanks for joining me today.
Absolutely. My pleasure, Chris. And hello, everyone. And Chris, I'm sorry to hear about your daughter, but glad she is doing okay. I know it's always tough when you don't know what's going on. So,
yeah, I'm sure they'll get to the. Well, I'm sure they'll get to the bottom of it eventually. But the emergency passed. Spent a nice, we were there about 5 hours or so, which is typical as they did all the things they need to do. But so far, so good.
I'm sure the listeners will forgive us for not having a show with very good reason. But good to be here today and happy to fill in for Jim and do my best here. I was actually spent most of the morning this morning working on some tax planning for a client that had some similar questions to those that we're going through today. So very topical for me.
Hey, before we get into questions, this is really for my own personal curiosity. what ended up happening with your, for those of you who don't know, Jake was in the office here in Colorado last week. He normally works out of his home office, we'll call it, in Chicago area. But he came out to visit us last week. Nice to see you, by the way.
Yeah, you as well.
But I heard through the grapevine there were some glitches in your return.
That is very true. And yeah, I was listening to the podcast that you and Jim did last week over the weekend talking about this. And it certainly was a saga. So Jim is absolutely right. And you too, Chris. And this is a lesson learned for me. In the summer, avoid flying in the afternoons at all cost. Yeah. Because the long and short of it was I had about a 5 p.m. flight out of Denver back to Chicago. I fly United, and there's about 10 direct flights a day, it seems like. Mm-hmm. And it was getting delayed, not necessarily due to the storms in Colorado, although there were a few little outbursts near the airport, but mostly because of what was going on in the Midwest, mm-hmm. and specifically kind of northern Illinois, southern Wisconsin area. There was a ground stop for quite a while. So it just kept getting delayed. And then eventually by about 11 p.m., 6 hours, you know, after it was supposed to leave, they finally canceled it, which I hate it when they do that, but kind of understand. And I'm thinking, all right, I'll just, you know, find a hotel and try again in the morning or something. And when I was trying to rebook, there was absolutely nothing. The person told me, next direct to Chicago flight we can get you on is Saturday evening. Mind you, this is almost midnight Thursday. And I'm like, well, that's nuts. I know I'm not going to stay here for two more days.
Yeah, with that many flights every day, I was surprised.
Yeah, I think it really, there's a lot of cancellations. And I think it just everything, you know, trying to rebook all those passengers on these full flights must have been the case. So, yeah, I got on a flight eventually that later that the next morning, early the next morning, it was like a 5:30 flight to Raleigh, North Carolina, and then to Chicago. Don't ask me why, but that was the one that had some seats. And so I took a nap in the airport for a little bit and got on the flight. And it was also delayed quite a bit. And then the connecting flight back to Chicago again was delayed. So I got home kind of mid-afternoon on Friday.
Oh, my gosh.
When I was expected to get home about 8 o'clock on Thursday night. So, yeah, it was a long day.
Yeah.
A long couple of days, but... all good now. These things happen.
Yeah, exactly. Well, glad you made it.
It's been a while, though, since I'd had a debacle like that.
Yeah, yeah. Luckily, those don't happen that often. I mean, frequent travelers, I'm sure, run into it regularly. But I've run into a couple of those, but not too recently, luckily. But yeah, I try to avoid in and out of Denver in the afternoon during the summer. Oh. Most of the time, the flights are going, but even if there's not a lot going on, it's still kind of an amusement park ride coming in.
Yeah.
So if you're trying to avoid that, I would avoid afternoons in the summertime coming in and out of Denver. It's always a little bumpy even in the wintertime, but it's exceptionally bad in the summer. And then they get those big, it's just positioned perfectly for those huge thunderstorms that build coming off the mountains to hit it out there. So on a stormy day, it's, you know, a lot of cancellations and stuff like that. So, but there's a beautiful view of the mountains flying in and out. So,
yeah, definitely.
There's an upside as well.
It's fun to watch sitting in Denver, just watching. Yeah, there was various storms. I don't know if you got it up not for north in Fort Collins, but around Denver, there were just all these little kind of pop up thunderstorms.
So we've got, let's see. So Jim sent us a bunch of questions because, as you all know, on the Q&A show, Jim is the collector of questions. I'll let you know right now, if you want to send in your own questions for the Q&A show, the way to do that is send an email directly to Jim. His email is jim@jimhelps.com. That's jim@jimhelps.com. In the subject line, indicate that it's a question for the podcast and include a couple words about the topic. That's always helpful as he's kind of sorting through them. And so he dug up and sent us 7. I'm hoping we'll get through all 7. None are super lengthy, so I do think we have a good chance of getting through all 7 of them, but we'll see. We'll just see how things go. And as normal, we'll start with a Social Security question. So I'll probably take the lead on this one. Sure. This first question, and since Jake and I both have the questions, we're going to go ahead and read state hints if people included them. And then I will reveal after we're done answering the question, the answer. So you can still play along at home, but Jake and I already know the answers because we have the emails in front of us, so we won't be guessing ourselves. So the state hint that they provide is, I live in the only state where governors are prohibited from holding office in consecutive terms. That's interesting. They have an alternative state hint, if that didn't do it for you. An art museum in this state has the largest public collection of Fabergé eggs outside of Russia.
There's no way I would have gotten this.
No. Here's a side question for people. Do you think Jim, being the normal reader of the questions, would have pronounced Fabergé properly? That's a question.
I would vote no.
I would vote no as well, but you never know.
You never know.
Sometimes he pulls out some tidbits that surprise me. So I'll reveal at the end, after we're done answering this, what the answer to this question is. Interesting hints. So the question, I've heard you answer several questions lately related to, quote, restricted, unquote, Social Security applications, outlining a strategy for applying for a spousal benefit, then transitioning to your own benefit. This assumes your spouse has already obtained Social Security benefits and that your spousal benefit is less than your own benefit based on your work. My question, in researching this topic online, several times I've come across a date of birth requirement that may impact your ability to utilize this strategy. Is it true that you must be born before 1954 to apply for a restricted Social Security benefit? If not, can you clarify what exactly changed when the toggle benefit, is what he's calling it, was eliminated and the impact of the 2015 law had on this spousal benefit? Then he gives us a scenario. The scenario, husband retired at 65 at full retirement age. He's now 70. That scenario doesn't quite work because if they turned full retirement age 5 years ago, turned 65 5 years ago, full retirement age would be 66. But the 65, you had to be born before 1943 in order to have 65 as your full retirement age. But that was likely just a typo. He is now 70. Wife still working is 63. Can the wife continue to work and receive spousal benefits, then retire at full retirement age and transition to her own full retirement age benefit? Thanks. Couple of things here. In the scenario, it kind of falls apart all over the place. I'll get to the short answer first because I don't want people to be misled by his description. The strategy he's describing is dead, period, for everyone. You had to be born before January 2nd of 1954 to retain the ability to file what he's describing accurately as a restricted application for Social Security benefits. His scenario actually wouldn't have worked even had he qualified by being born before January 2nd of 1954, because you never were able to do this strategy prior to your full retirement age. And he's describing a scenario where the wife is 63, wanted to file just for spousal benefits, then switch to her own benefit. That's not how it works. When you file prior to your full retirement age, the history on this is, prior to your full retirement age, you were always deemed to be filing for your own benefit, even if you just wanted to file for a spousal benefit. So it's called the deeming rule. And that applied to people prior to their full retirement age, I believe from ages ago. What was allowed for people now born before January 2nd of 1954, and prior to this 2015 law that went into effect, is that after your full retirement age, you were at that time, prior to the change in the law, able to go to Social Security and say, I would like my own benefit to remain unclaimed and earn delayed retirement credits. I intend to file it later at 70. I'm giving the backstory of why you might want to do this, to 70. Right now, I want to file just for my spousal benefit. And so I want to file a restricted application, restricting it just to the spousal benefit. And prior to the change in law in 2015, this was allowed if you were full retirement age or older. So people in certain circumstances would do this. They would file for their own. They would, file for their spousal benefit only, letting their own grow in the background and then switch, getting the benefits of delay, but collecting something in the meantime. Well, this was put to rest in that 2015 law. The exact title of it escapes me. But they grandfathered people in that were allowed to do it, and the grandfathering was described as, you were only able to still continue to do this if you were born before January 2nd of 1954. Now, the only time you would do this generally is if you are waiting to claim your own, and we all know that you don't wait to claim your own beyond age 70. So once you reach 70, the attractiveness of the scenario disappears. You would never try to do this once you'd reached age 70. Well, guess what? People born January 1st of 1954, which is the oldest people, or youngest people, sorry, who could actually still deploy this strategy due to the grandfathering, they all turned 70 January 1st of 2024. On that day, this strategy became dead for everyone, because those folks that were grandfathered in no longer would benefit from doing it, and nobody else could do it if they were born after that January 1st of 1954. So I'm going into this detail because even though this is dead and kind of knowing the history of it isn't really beneficial now because you can't do it, there's mention of this still out there on the internet. And there might be, even in the archives of our own show, discussion of this if you go back far enough. But there's definitely references to this out there on the internet, that if you didn't realize the law had changed, you would be misled in your ability to do this. Now, when you went to Social Security to try to do it, it would all fall apart. They would deny you being able to do it. But yes, this was a strategy before. The other thing that would kind of blow a hole in his scenario is if he said she's still working. Mm-hmm. So she's also going to be affected by the earnings test. So say she could have done this, which she, in his scenario, never could, because the wife is below full retirement age, might not have benefited because of the earnings test, right? So this really was a strategy once people turned full retirement age that they used to be able to do, but it is, as I mentioned, now dead and gone. So if you see reference to this out there for spousal benefit claiming, ignore it. But I need to immediately remind people that this approach is still available for people who are eligible for simultaneously a survivor benefit and their own benefit. The law did not change the ability for you to file solely for a survivor benefit, leaving your own unaffected, unclaimed, and then later switch to your own benefit without any penalty for having previously claimed the survivor, or vice versa, claim your own benefit at a younger age and then later claim the survivor benefit, that later survivor benefit switch or toggle, like he mentioned in his question here, completely unaffected by your earlier claiming of your own benefit. That's not technically called filing a restricted application, but because it behaves so much like one, I and others usually call it filing a restricted application, but technically in Social Security jargon, they don't refer to it as such. So that's still out there. So if you hear somebody talking about that, make sure you don't confuse or conflate spousal benefits and survivor benefits. A lot of people get those two mixed up or think they're the one and the same thing. They are not. They are two separate and distinct benefits with different rules. And spousal benefits are what were addressed in this law change in 2015, and the deeming of your own benefit. There is no deeming forcing you to claim your own benefit if you simply want to claim the survivor benefit or vice versa. They don't deem between those two. So right. There are still people that exploit, sounds like a bad word, exploit this strategy, if you will, when they simultaneously have access to a survivor and a and their own retirement benefit. So always make sure for your own knowledge and for maybe friends of yours, if they have lost their spouse, don't treat, you know, be very careful on claiming Social Security, because Social Security will not advise you as to a better or worse way of claiming. They'll provide information, but they are barred from kind of counseling with you to say, oh, you'd get more money if you did it this way, that kind of thing. So you need to make sure before you just run down the Social Security office and claim either your own or the survivor benefit, you need to look at all the possibilities of the order in which you claim, because unfortunately there's a lot of people who do it without looking into it and leave a bunch of money on the table. I'll just say it like mm-hmm. that. There's been numbers of cases I've seen where, you know, and you can't go back and redo it easily. That's even if you try to do the withdrawal of your own benefit, you can only do that within 12 months. And you have to pay back all the money that you've received in order to reset things. And that's messy, hard to do. Most people don't do that. So always make sure that you are confident that you are claiming Social Security in the best way for you before you go down and do it. Put some thought into it, some research into it, in particular, if you've lost your spouse. If you've lost your spouse and have not yet claimed any benefit, make sure and if you're not confident in your own research, reach out to someone who's an expert in Social Security claiming. Make sure you're not going to do something that you'll regret by leaving money on the table. So I just want to provide that advice as well.
Yeah, that's good advice.
Yeah. Okay.
So your options.
Yeah. Answer to the question, the quiz. So to remind you, state hint was, I live in the only state where governors are prohibited from holding office in consecutive terms. And then they added, the state also has an art museum that has the largest public collection of Fabergé eggs outside of Russia. And the answer is Virginia. And it's the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts that has that collection. So there's the answer to our quiz question here. Nice. So next question, this one's actually, I call this a PSA. Remember how we've, on a few of the past shows, we've talked about people running into difficulties with documentation sharing with Social Security and maybe not getting back original documents that they sent in to Social Security, which Social Security promises to and is supposed to return to you. There's also been some issues with people claiming spousal benefits and they had to provide proof of being married. And so this one will be pretty quick. I'll just, this is another one of those sharing other listeners' experiences to better inform what you should expect when dealing with Social Security. Says, Chris and Jim, I wanted to share with you our recent experience applying for Social Security benefits, spousal benefits. My wife and I have been married for 25 years. My wife applied for Social Security benefits in 2020 when she reached her full retirement age. In December 2024, I applied for my Social Security benefits to start in March of 2025 when I turned 70. In January of 25, so a month after he applied, my wife tried to apply online for spousal benefits to start in March of 2025. Social Security website, however, prevented her from completing her online application, and a message stated she had to speak with a Social Security agent to complete the application. As in-person appointments were not an option, my wife tried calling Social Security. After 14-plus hours on hold over several days, she still had not spoken with an agent. It was so bad that she actually paid a service $20 to wait on hold for her. After two more days, this finally worked and she was able to speak with a human in February of 2025. The agent told her that she had to bring a copy of our marriage certificate to our local office for her application to be completed. The next available appointment would be in April. So wow. 2 months after she finally talks to a human on the phone. A week after meeting at the Social Security office, her spousal benefits application was approved and she received a retroactive payment for March. For us, we had to show a physical copy of the marriage certificate even after 25 years of marriage and 25 years of filing our taxes as married filing jointly. Note that my wife had a different last name, so that may be a factor. In hindsight, I wish that we had submitted our marriage certificate to Social Security long before we applied for spousal benefits. And I love that he said that, because that is my recommendation to you all out there as well. Because of the clogging up of the customer service channels at Social Security these days, which appear to be doing nothing but getting worse, you need to be more proactive. You need to call, make an appointment for your local Social Security office. And when I say local, doesn't have to be the one closest to you. Just has to be a Social Security office. Look around, check at multiple locations. You might have to drive a little bit, but maybe you can get an appointment a much easier or much earlier than at the one closest to you, and it'd be worth driving to that location. But make an appointment where you can take, and the reason why you want to make an appointment and not just send in your marriage certificate is that you probably won't get it back. Now, if you have multiple copies of it, and it needs to be a certified copy that looks, you know, official, it can't be just a photocopy that you made. If you have multiples, you can get multiple official marriage certificates. If you have one of those and you don't mind never seeing it again, you could attempt sending it in. But even those sending it in have found that all this mail is piling up somewhere in who knows whose office and taken forever. At least when you go to an appointment, you show up, they scan it, hand it back to you, enter it into the system, and now you know it's done. You have, you know, a known completion of them getting a copy of the marriage certificate. So I would do that. And if you plan ahead, you won't have to worry about arguing for retroactive payments and, you know, run the chance that things really string along and you maybe have to get your senator involved and all that kind of mess. I would proactively set an appointment to supply the marriage certificate in order to get this done well ahead of you actually wanting to claim spousal benefits. And I didn't notice at the bottom here, even though it's not a question, a PSA, he did give us some state trivia. It is, I live in the state where Bing Crosby was born. I think we might have had this one before.
I do too.
So, Washington State is where this one came in from. So thank you so much for this, sharing your experience. It helps other people. I had no idea you could pay a service $20 to wait on hold for you. It's a very sad state of affairs when you have to do that, for any service, but this is one that, I mean, Social Security should not be like this.
No.
This is a well developed system, been around forever. And, I had somebody email me a while back, generally, essentially saying, well, you know, the thing needs to be restructured, all this kind of stuff. And I couldn't agree more. They were kind of making the argument that all these delays are reasons modernizing and doing all this stuff. I agree with you. I think my interpretation of what's been happening over the past several years and accelerating now is that they want to, you know, reduce the overhead, reduce the number of people, trying to get people to do it on the phone, online, that kind of thing. But they failed to take the initial step of the investment in modernization of everything that could then offload the work from the humans that do, through no fault of their own. These are not humans working at Social Security that don't know how to do their job for the most part. There's always exceptions, but it's just that they're overwhelmed because they don't have enough manpower and enough resources. And so one of the two things needs to happen. And I think they need to, you know, grow the human resources first to kind of fix this problem in the short term, then spend some money, oh, the horror, to modernize the system, to reduce the need for humans. And maybe have a way for you to submit your marriage certificate online or them link to some records and automatically do these things so you don't have to make an appointment to have your Social Security document or your marriage certificate scanned in. Those are all things that take a lot of human effort, right? And time. Yeah. I'm all for finding a modern way to avoid that. But you can't put the cart before the horse. You can't say, well, we're going to, you know, we're going to be more modern, but you reduce the workforce before the modernization. Are you kidding me?
Right.
That just seems crazy. And yeah, I mean, I'm fairly animated about this because I'm constantly hearing these stories. And this has gone well beyond a few anecdotal stories. This is a systematic problem that's going on. And it's, you know, if it's not affecting you yet, it's going to, because I guess unless you're, you know, not covered by Social Security, which is a chunk of people, but the vast majority of us are eventually going to have to be interacting with Social Security to get the benefits that we were promised, eligible for, earned through our working lives. And I think it's unacceptable to have these kind of issues in this type of a program. So just putting that out there.
Especially with the volume of people now reaching ages where they're eligible to claim. I mean,
exactly.
It goes hand in hand with these reductions in work.
Exactly. Okay. The next one is going to be more up Jake's alley here. So this is, it's got a Social Security twist to it, as you're going to see in a second, but is kind of a tax issue. So I'll let Jake take the lead on this. It says, hi, Jim and Chris. If tips are not taxed, will this affect how much a worker receives in Social Security benefits when they are elderly? I'm guessing that other than the high-end restaurant maitre d', most tip-dependent employees are paying very little in taxes under the current system. Might this be a short-sighted policy for the most financially vulnerable? Thanks for your wisdom. So no state hint on this, but what do you think about that, Jake?
I think a good question and a reasonable hypothesis, I think, for sure. So let's just talk again. We'll talk a little bit through this. This was part of the new tax bill that came out, or that was signed on July 4th. And Paul and Chris and I talked a bit about this on last week's EDU show. But I guess the quick answer is that the no tax on tips, quote unquote, is really, think about it as no income tax on certain tips. And I'll dive into what that means in a second. They're still, those tipped employees are still having deductions for FICA taxes, so your Social Security and Medicare taxes. So they're still contributing to that work record with Social Security, even though they're not paying income tax on some of these tips as a result of this law. So still earning those quarterly credits if applicable, towards their Social Security work history. So that's the quick answer to his question. And the way that this has at least been laid out so far, there's still a couple of things pending, but it's basically effective this year, 2025 through 2028, so 4 years, that employees may deduct qualified tips received in occupations that are going to be listed by the IRS as customarily and regularly receiving tips. And this is kind of important, on or before December 31st, 2024. So this list is set to be published, at least according to the IRS website. Guidance will be published by October 2nd of this year, 2025. That list of occupations that, again, customarily and regularly receive tips on or before December 31st, 2024. And I believe the reason that they're kind of looking at this retroactively is so that, businesses aren't, kind of creating these quote unquote tipped positions now that this bill is passed, in an effort to shield some of either themselves or their employees being able to deduct the tips moving forward for the next 4 years. That's just my guess, something like that. There are some limits around this, though. So it's, again, the maximum annual deduction is $25,000. And if you're a self-employed individual, the deduction cannot exceed your net income. So that's important. And then there's also a phase out. So the deduction phases out for taxpayers with modified adjusted gross income of $150,000 for single filers or $300,000 for joint filers. And I believe it's 10% per 10,000, I want to say. I don't have that right in front of me, but I believe that's the phase out. So about $100,000 above each of those, you'll be completely phased out.
Right. So again, at the top, you said your short answer, because they're right. still withholding Social Security and Medicare taxes, not, they're just not doing income taxes on the eligible tips. You're still getting credit for, you know, your Social Security earnings record on all of those reported tips. So, hope that clarifies it for this particular listener, but, be interesting to see that list that comes out, the customary, the restriction list.
Regularly.
Yeah. And regularly. I think there's some obvious ones we'll expect, but it'll be interesting to see if there's some surprises on that list that, people are then allowed to deduct that $25,000 on there.
Yeah. We'll see.
It'll be interesting. Yeah.
So we'll and watch it's again, just another kind of note. It doesn't, you can deduct this if you fit this, criteria. You don't have to itemize in order to take these tip deductions.
I'm glad you mentioned that because a lot of people think, oh, there's all these things, but unless I itemize, it's no big deal. This is one where you're going to get benefit of it, whether you itemize or not. So it'll be on top of the standard deduction if that's what you're taking.
Yep. And we'll have to see. I mean, I'm sure they're, scrambling to update tax forms and to get them ready for the 2025 filing season. Luckily, it's still a few months away.
Yeah. Got it. Okay. Next question. Okay. So this one is a bit of an annuity question. This is, let's see, it's not, they're not really a hint and everybody will know this, but it's the home of the world's most famous and humble investor, Mr. Warren Buffett. So I think very few people would not know that that means Nebraska. He's in Omaha specifically. But, pretty short question here, but I'll let you deal with a tax question that they've got. I'm helping a brother who has limited savings for retirement. He will mostly depend on Social Security, but does have about $90,000 in a traditional IRA. I am considering recommending a SPIA, which stands for Single Premium Immediate Annuity, to supplement his Social Security. He has no heirs to leave money to, and I'm just considering his best option to maximize his minimum dignity floor. If the SPIA is purchased with the traditional IRA funds, are the monthly payments considered income for tax purposes forever? I'm pretty sure the answer is yes, but want it confirmed. Thanks for all your team does. Love your show and listen while doing my daily walks. So we've got another walker, jogger, exerciser. Yeah, yeah. So why don't you walk people through the taxability of annuity payments. So here a single premium immediate annuity is specifically what's being mentioned here. The what I usually call the purest form of an annuity, which is you hand a lump of money to the insurance company and in return they promise to pay you an agreed upon amount, oftentimes monthly, but could be other timing, but an agreed upon amount every year, generally for the rest of your life. That's kind of the basic plain vanilla version of it. There's other ways you can ask for payments over set periods and things, but it's for, in this case, I'm sure they're talking about a lifetime payment because they're using it in the way we like to use SPIAs, which is to help a person have enough secure income to cover their minimum dignity floor expenses through their whole life. So they don't have to worry about, or at least worry less about running out of money to cover the most basic needs in life, the food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare that we include in what we define as your minimum dignity floor. So, what's the taxation of those payments, Jake?
Yeah. So first of all, Georgette from Nebraska, nice of you to help your brother and potentially take some of the knowledge you've gained, from here or other sources to help him kind of shore up his minimum dignity floor, I guess, assuming his Social Security may not cover it. And he's got this $90,000 in a traditional IRA. Well, when you think about annuity, the taxation of annuity payments, really the kind of vehicle or the type of account that annuity is purchased in is going to set the taxability of those future payments. So in this case, if this person were to move forward, and Chris will dive into some of the watch outs here, but if it's purchased within the traditional annuity, it will come out as ordinary and those payments will be considered ordinary income moving forward. Whether they receive them monthly or annually as part of their taxable income moving forward. So that's kind of one way to remember that. Now, if this was done with non-qual money or just, you had some cash sitting in a bank or a brokerage account that you were going to look to purchase an annuity, That would follow the other annuity rules. But for these quality, you know, something in an IRA, it's going to be considered IRA distributions or ordinary income.
Yeah, and if it's a Roth, which wasn't the topic of this question, then all those payments would be tax-free as long as they
tax-free,
were coming out.
Exactly.
Right, but if it's a non-retirement account that you're buying the annuity within or using dollars not inside of a retirement account, then the annuity rules, and those are a little different. Those depending on how you have the annuity payments set up, they'll be maybe partially taxable for a period of time before they become fully taxable later on. There's very specific rules there. But once it goes inside of the wrapper of an IRA, either traditional or Roth, then none of those rules applied to, you know, the annuity rules apply to the taxation. It's all the container, the IRA container, that determines the taxability of those payments. And in this case, they'd be 100% taxable for forever as long as payments were coming out of there. Now, a word of warning that I'll put out, just because of the scenario that she described, you said he's got $90,000 in traditional IRA. If that's all that he has, he's actually likely to find it difficult to buy an annuity. And the reason is, and insurance companies have to follow very specific suitability rules. And one thing they're always concerned with when these suitability rules are set, which are essentially controlled by the insurance regulators in each state, insurance companies and their behavior are regulated on the state level. Now, there's a lot of consistency among the states, so you'll see a lot of commonality, but there are differences state to state in certain circumstances. But it is ultimately the state insurance regulators that guide what insurance companies can, how they can behave, essentially. And one thing they're worried about is liquidity. And for a SPIA, for instance, if you were to buy a SPIA, you now no longer have access to that $90,000. You're just going to be getting the, you know, the $90,000 SPIA is not going to buy a whole lot. Depending on his age, that $90,000 might only buy, you know, $5,400 a year, maybe. So we're talking maybe hundreds of dollars a month that would be coming out of there. And that's it. If he suddenly needed money for a medical issue or something like that, he now has no liquidity. And so the regulators aren't going to let insurance companies put a person in that position. So with only $90,000, even if a SPIA would be authorized to be purchased, would be approved, it's going to be much smaller than $90,000, and that's not going to do a lot. Now, if he's just kind of, you know, on the edge and just needs a few hundred, you know, dollars a month extra, and that would really help him out and it works well in his circumstances, possible. But I think you're going to run into a little bit of difficulty here. I think probably alternative approaches to managing his retirement are going to be needed here, and some kind of effort to control costs, to try to get him to mostly live within Social Security, because that $90,000 probably isn't doing a whole lot. And I'm assuming that's all he has, or you would have mentioned it, that that's all he's got. I sense that's all he has really outside of Social Security. That really needs to be a cushion for an unanticipated event or an occasional need, and probably shouldn't be considered part of the day-to-day living, because it's going to be exhausted. It's going to be exhausted pretty quickly, which I think is probably why she was interested in a SPIA, because then the payments would continue forever. Right. If he lived long enough to go through the whole $90,000. But I think liquidity is going to be a problem, and he's likely not going to be able to buy a SPIA. So it's a unfortunate situation. I hope that, good news is if he's also in Nebraska, there's a lot of areas in Nebraska that have a pretty modest, cost of living. So, that's good. While they don't, one thing that's always kind of fascinated me is that they don't scale or adjust your Social Security depending on where you live. Yeah. And so Social Security for someone in Nebraska, Missouri, you know, Wyoming, certain parts of Colorado, even not so much anymore, but classically a lot of Midwest states, the flyover states, affectionately, have a lot of places the cost of living is low enough where Social Security can cover a lot of someone's living expenses. But if you live in a high cost area, the same Social Security benefits aren't going to cover nearly as much of your base living expenses. And that's just the way it is. That's yeah. just the way Social Security is set up. So, yeah, I wish you and your brother luck, and it's great that you're trying to help him out, and I hope that you find a good solution that works for him. Okay. Boy, this is a super short question, but we can talk about some moving parts here. So this question is regarding NQDC payments. So NQDC stands for non-qualified deferred compensation, which is a fancy way of saying it's deferred compensation, kind of like when you would defer your income into a 401k or other retirement account. It is non-qualified, so it is not part of the ERISA protected group, like 401ks that get certain legal protections from creditors, etc. It's not a separate account that belongs to you. While those dollars are in this, quote, account, they are actually the dollars of the company where you worked. So if that company were to go into bankruptcy or something, the creditors would be able to attach those dollars. They are not yours protected. They were part of the company's dollars. So that's what non-qualified deferred compensation is. That's a very short description. So this super straightforward question, or at least simple question, which we have several things to talk about, just simply says, "Hi, Jim. I retired last year. I have non-qualified deferred comp payments coming until 2039. Are these payments included in MAGI or MAGI or however you decide? I like MAGI. That's my preference. MAGI, which stands for Modified Adjusted Gross Income, and hence impact IRMA, Income-Related Monthly Adjustment Amount. In other words, Medicare premium surcharges. So do these payments, non-qualified deferred comp, get sucked into MAGI, therefore would affect IRMA?" Yeah. And that's the question. What say you, Jake?
I say, appreciate the concise question here. And the answer is yes. Those payments are included in the MAGI and hence impact IRMA. And if you think about it, you know, what's a deferred compensation payment? I mean, these are typically offered to higher compensated employees during their career as a way to, just like they say, defer realizing that income while they're working in exchange for this stream of income after they retire. And, you know, one thing to note on these is that the FICA taxes, so the Social Security, Medicare payroll taxes, are deducted in the year the money was actually earned. So you're only paying income tax when you receive these deferred comp payments. So just your income taxes. And you'd been deferring tax on these for who knows how long, right? Keeping your taxable income, you know, somewhat lower while you're working, earning more. And now, you know, now that your income has stopped, these payments come in. So it is included in your adjusted gross income for IRMA or for your on your tax return. So it is included. These payments are included in your adjusted gross income. And when it comes to the modified adjusted gross income or the MAGI, specifically for determining IRMA. Now, there are, as Chris has mentioned many times on the show before, there are many different definitions of MAGI, right? It depends on what we're talking about. So specifically for IRMA, so these monthly income-related monthly adjustment amount or what some people refer to as your increase in Medicare Part B and D payments, the MAGI is your adjusted gross income. So you can find that right on your tax return before you take any deductions, plus any tax exempt interest. And it's really just those two pieces.
Right.
Your adjusted gross income plus any tax exempt interest is what is the MAGI that you would then go to the table and figure out where you fall in terms of this income-related monthly adjustment amounts or IRMA.
Right.
So I can give you kind of a quick overview of what those are. The other thing, and a lot of listeners will know this, but when you're looking at potential IRMA impact in a given year, remember it's always looking at the MAGI from 2 years prior. So for 2025, even though we're already halfway through, those of you on Medicare that may or may not be affected by IRMA is because of your income in 2023. And if your 2023 income, I'll just list married filing jointly, and if you're single, you can cut it in half. If you had $212,000 of modified adjusted gross income, you're not paying any IRMA. There's no surcharge there. You're paying whatever the Part B premium was, which is about $185 a month. If you're $1 over, though, so $212,001 up to $266,000, you're in what we typically refer to as first paid IRMA tier, where you'd be subject to about $74 on your Part B premiums and a little over $13 on your Part D premiums. And the brackets go up from there. They don't follow exact, they're not following the, you know, the 12, the 22, the 24, the 32% marginal federal income tax brackets. They have their own kind of system that's actually a bit more compressed between that initial for married filing jointly couple, 212, up to about 400,000. There's, you know, three different paid tiers within there. And you can Google that or find it online if you're curious. But yeah, that was a long answer to the question of yes, those non-qualified deferred comp payments are included in your adjusted gross income and thus your modified adjusted gross income for IRMA.
Yeah. Another thing I'll point out, because there's, I'm sure, a number of listeners, and I know that because we have a number of clients that, and you know, maybe you started as podcast listeners, ultimately became clients that have non-qualified deferred comp, that we have found that, you know, those of you worried about IRMA are probably looking into SSA 44, which is the form that you file to appeal your IRMA. Essentially, it's appealing how they calculate IRMA. There's no way to appeal and say, please don't, you know, charge me IRMA. It's more, please use a different reference year for Maggie to determine my IRMA, one that's advantageous to me. That's kind of the simplest way to describe it. And so those of you filing SSA 44 know that there's two triggers for a successful SSA 44. One, that you have a qualifying event, and there's, you know, seven things I believe listed on there as qualifying events. The one that applies to most people is reduction of work, which is, you know, retirement is a form of reduction of work or reduction of income. And, so that reduction of work is a trigger, among others. And then also, I said there's got to be two things. You have to, in a more recent year, have lower income than the year they're using to determine your IRMA. If those two things are true, you usually get granted the IRMA exception. And, but what we found with non-qualified deferred comp, especially for people receiving it over long periods of time, here he said he's meant receiving it through 2039. So he started it last year, 2024. So he's got a 15-year deferred comp payout. Oftentimes, the payout isn't even for that whole 15 years. And so, and the reason for that is usually that each year that you earn deferred comp, it gets treated under its own payout schedule. So if you had a year where you deferred a lot, that's going to be maybe under a 10-year payout schedule that you elected, or maybe you elected 5 years, or for a variety of reasons, his payout might actually decline over time in that 15-year period. And we're finding that referencing the original retirement as the triggering event, people have had SSA for multiple SSA 44 forms approved as their deferred comp reduced. Maybe after 3 years it reduced, and then 3 years later it reduced more, etc. And the advantage of doing that, you know, eventually you'll get a lower IRMA, but it kind of accelerates the reduction in your IRMA if you successfully file an SSA 44. So just know that. I'm just giving this as a heads up. Might not work in your circumstances, but know that even if your retirement was 6 or 7 or 8 years ago, that can still be the triggering event for your income reduction today. Because this deferred comp was triggered by the reduction in work, your retirement, and the reduction in income is happening today. But it was a result of something, the triggering event 6, 7, 8 years ago. That actually works. I wasn't sure it would until I heard from folks that they successfully did that. So could the rules change in the future? Policy change and that not work? Maybe, but keep that in your quiver of arrows of things to deploy maybe and look into during your retirement.
Yeah, I think that's interesting.
Yeah. When they shared that worked, I was very surprised. I was happy that it happened. And thinking about it, it makes sense. There's nothing in there that says that event, in this case, the reduction of work, which was retirement, has to be within a certain period. There's nothing in the, I read through, I'm like, boy, can that be true? No, there's no reference to it. And that must be why they're getting them approved. Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Next one. I think we're going to make it through all these. So next question. Is there a...
I don't think so.
No hint on this one. And this one came through our blog site, helpwithmysocialsecurity.com. Although it doesn't seem to be a Social Security question. Oh, either way. So we got a question somehow submitted to us. It just didn't come to Jim's email. And question's this. Hi, Jim and Chris. I have a traditional and Roth IRA at Vanguard. I want to convert a portion of the traditional to Roth. I cannot find a definitive answer to when to pay the taxes. My preferred method is when I file yearly taxes in the following February. If I do, will there be a penalty for not paying quarterly? Thank you. So this is right up your alley, Jake. Why don't you?
Yeah, this is a great question. Yeah. Blog/podcast listener, observer, however you found us. Thank you. So let's talk about this a little bit. So fairly common situation, traditional IRA, they want to do some Roth conversions. And the question we get all the time, when do I pay the taxes? How do I pay the taxes? When are they due? Let's just all ground ourselves that the United States tax system is a quote unquote pay as you go system. So if you think about that, it makes sense. As you're working, let's say you're getting paid every other week or once a month, your employer is deducting, a portion of that for, federal income taxes, state income taxes, if applicable. So you're effectively paying the taxes due as you move throughout the year. Well, when you're looking at, realizing income, which is what from a tax standpoint, when you're converting money from a traditional to a Roth IRA, you are voluntarily saying, all right, I want to pay the tax on this portion of whatever the conversion is. I've been deferring it all this time. Now I'm raising my hand. I'm coming forward. I'm saying, I'm ready to convert. I'm paying the taxes. The money goes into the Roth and now it can grow tax-free. And it can be withdrawn tax-free under making sure you hit all of the rules that we're not going to get into today. And so you can also think about that as a pay-as-you-go system. So there's some factors here that I do want to acknowledge. It'll depend on the size of the conversion. I mean, if it's so small that you're not going to even, trigger taxation and you're still going to be in the 0% bracket, then it doesn't matter. But if you're, let's say you do a conversion, and you do a $100,000 conversion in July, right? You do a $100,000 conversion in July. You don't have anything withheld. You wait. You reconcile your taxes in February, according to this this email, and you figure out what your taxes are going to be owed for the year. Well, if you didn't make any payments along the way, there's a chance that you could be faced with an underpayment penalty. And what that essentially is looking through the year again, I don't know what all your other income sources are. So that's why I said there's a lot of caveats here. But if this is your only income source, it's going to be deemed to you have not, the government didn't get, the IRS didn't get any taxes throughout the year. So when you go to file your return, they're going to be like, we got $100,000. You earned $100,000. You didn't pay any taxes all year. So it's going to apply penalties throughout the year based on that quote unquote underpayment. So an easy way to do this, let's say I'm going to park withholding taxes from the actual conversion itself just for a minute. We'll put that off to the side. Let's say you don't want to do that. You want to get all that $100,000 from your traditional IRA into your Roth IRA. Well, what you would do and what we would advise is at the time of the conversion, go ahead and figure out what the estimated taxes would be on that conversion and make a estimated payment during that quarter so that you are deemed to be paid up for your taxes through that quarter. That is probably the easiest, well, maybe not the easiest, but a straightforward way with which to do that. Another thing you can do, and you've heard us talk about this, but I think it bears repeating, taxes withheld. So let's say you're, you know, you told us your Vanguard is your custodian, I believe. Yeah. You do the conversion. And when you're doing it online at Vanguard, or whether you do it online or on the phone, they're going to say, hey, do you want to withhold any federal income taxes from this conversion? And if you elect yes, then they're going to send the money directly from your traditional IRA to the Treasury Department to pay your taxes. And you'll get, let's say you make a $10,000 tax payment, so $90,000 goes into the Roth. That is deemed to have been paid equally throughout the year. So that is one way, especially for folks that are doing kind of a later in the year Roth conversion, you know, November, December, you know, especially if it's sizable, that's going to greatly increase their taxable income for the year. You know, that is one way to get out of potential underpayment penalties, is rather than pay your taxes from another account, like a bank account or a brokerage account, go ahead and just have the custodian withhold some tax, send it on your behalf. And again, like I said, it's deemed to have been paid equally throughout the year, so there would not be any underpayment penalties. There could be, you know, as you're doing your taxes, one way to ensure that this, and it's a little outside the scope of this question, but I'll just mention it here, is if you earn uneven income throughout the year, and Roth conversions typically lend themselves to falling into that category, right? Even if you're getting annuity payments, Social Security payments throughout the year, you know, consistently, and then you do a $100,000 Roth conversion in November, well, you know, when you're filing your taxes, it just looks like you had a bunch of income and you didn't pay, you know, you underpaid your taxes. If you go in to form 2210, form 2210, it's a way to annualize your income throughout the year. And you're basically just telling the IRS that in Q1, I only earned, you know, $15,000, Q2, I earned $15,000, Q3, I earned $15,000, Q4, I earned $115,000, again, including that $100,000 conversion. But I made the quarterly payment, or I'm making the payment prior to January 15th, because that's when the Q4 payment is due. Then you would not be assessed any penalties because of underpayment. So a couple different things to think about when you're doing this.
Yeah. So it's,
what do you think, Chris?
No, I think it's, I mean, there's a few ways to deal with this. I think it's, silly to pay an under withholding penalty when you can avoid it a number of ways. Yeah. Even though you like to wait until the following February when you file, I would, recommend that you take steps to avoid that, because those are just extra. You're just signing up to voluntarily pay a tax that you wouldn't otherwise have to pay, which at its, you know, face value seems silly. And on this, what about you? We talk about how this might be their only or, you know, most of their income throughout the year. If they've got other withholdings that they're making, can't they just, and I apologize, I got distracted at one point with a message. Did you go through the safe harbor rules?
No, thank you. I was going to, and I lost my train of thought there. Yeah,
so it's, there's a way that if you withhold a certain amount compared to what you either owe or what you owed last year, that you kind of then don't have to worry about this. So maybe walk people through that.
Yeah. The other consideration here is to think through what the IRS calls the safe harbor rule. And this may make, you know, your question moot, or maybe not, but I think it'll be helpful for others. So the basic criteria here is, as long as you pay at least 90% of your current year tax liability, then you will not owe any penalties. You won't, even if, you know, as long as you've paid 90% of the current year's tax liability, you know, throughout the year. So like Chris said, if you've got other sources of income, whether you're having tax withheld throughout the year and you do a bit of a conversion at the end of the year, go ahead and look, figure out, you know, all right, well, here's my taxable income estimate for the year. Here's the taxes I've already paid in. Did I pay in 90%? If the answer is yes, then cool. No estimated payment needed. No additional withholding on that conversion needed. You're good to go, and you can settle up in February like you outlined in your question. The other kind of safe harbor rule is based on the previous year's tax liability. So this is a way to do it as well, because maybe you were working full-time and this is your first year where you're not working full-time. If you pay 100% of the previous year's tax liability, then you can avoid penalties by paying, you know, you paid the same amount in tax that you paid the prior year, you are deemed to be within the safe harbor. Now that 100% figure I just gave you is on adjusted gross income of $150,000 or less. If your adjusted gross income is $150,000 or more, instead of 100% of the previous year's tax liability, you need to have paid at least 110% of the previous year's tax liability. So those are kind of the two kind of safe harbor guidelines, or the get me out of penalty guideline, if you want to think about it that way. 90% of what you owe in the current tax year, or 100% if your AGI is 150,000 or less, and 110% if your AGI is $150,000 or more of the prior year's tax liability. So I know we're throwing a lot at you here, but it really does depend, you know, on your situation and what your prior year's tax liability was, your current year, other income from different sources, including any withholdings. So there, you know, there's a possibility you won't need to do anything. Again, I don't know the size of the conversion you're doing or your situation at all. But those are just some considerations for, you know, for this listener and for anyone out there when they're trying to assess, hey, do I need to make a quarterly estimated payment? You know, it's worth looking at.
Yeah, and just know that the safe harbor is usually really just beneficial for maybe a surprise instance, because it only really helps you the first year, maybe if you're going to do a series of large, say, $100,000 Roth conversions or something. That first year, you might get saved by the safe harbor because you easily withheld at least 100 or 110% of the previous year's taxes. But the previous year, you didn't do a Roth conversion. Then fast forward the next year. Now last year included a $100,000 Roth conversion, which generated a lot of taxes. And so now your safe harbor is much, much higher, right? Than what you had before. So you kind of get a 1 year of, oops, I should have withheld, right? I should have sent in quarterly payments, but I didn't, because I've started this new strategy, we'll call it, of recognizing a bunch of income proactively via conversions. And so you kind of escape that first year, but then thereafter, you need to be a lot more proactive and make sure that you're doing, you know, quarterly or, you know, however you intend to pay the taxes, whether it's kind of, we call it from the conversion, by sending money in from the retirement accounts themselves, or you're paying it from non-retirement accounts or cash you have laying around or something like that. But, you need to be more proactive. Otherwise, you know, in year two of this strategy, safe harbor isn't gonna save you because you'll have withheld way, way under the safe harbor limits because the previous year has got that Roth conversion in there. So
be aware of that. This can be, you know, we get this from, you know, clients that we do either planning help with or tax planning is, you know, they're not used to paying estimated payments. They've been W-2 employees their whole career. You know, they've just had their employer withhold it from their paychecks. And now they're kind of on their own in this kind of wild, wild world of, you know, really filing in and figuring out what income do I want to realize this year, whether it's through conversions or distributions from those retirement accounts. And so getting kind of familiar with this quarterly system can be helpful because, like Chris said, you know, estimated tax, you know, penalties, underpayment penalties, they're not the end of the world, but they're not awesome, right? I think it's about 7% right now.
Right.
And they're easy to avoid. You know, you can do it online. You know, it's at IRS, make a payment. You know, it's very, very simple and quick to do. You don't have to mail a check or anything. You can if you want. But yeah, you can pay throughout the year just to make sure you avoid this. Don't pay more than you need to, but at least pay kind of what is due in that current period.
Yeah. Sounds good. Okay. Last question we've got here.
Last one.
Let's see if there's a hint. No hint on this one. They do make a point of saying, that they love the podcast, whether the AI is included or not. So one of the previous emails, I didn't read it at the bottom, but they thanked us for doing away with the ChatGPT participating in the state trivia. So here's one they didn't, they're
neutral. Who knew it'd be such a polarizing topic?
This person's neutral, but it has been pretty polarizing. Yeah, with mostly people didn't like how we were doing. I personally didn't like it very much either. It kind of gummed up the show a little bit. So, here we go. Diving into the question. I recently retired at 65. My wife and I are now in the quote delay period. So I'm going to pause and describe that for people who don't know what he means by that. That's language we use in our planning process. The delay period for us is the period of time between retirement and when your secure income is fully turned on, usually your Social Security, which could be as late as 70. So he's in that delay period. The significance of the delay period in our process or our minds is that this is a period where you are more heavily relying upon distributions from your accounts to live on, because your income, your secure income, which could be pensions, Social Security, income annuity if you have it, hasn't turned on yet, because you're waiting for some reason. For Social Security, you're usually waiting to make the monthly benefit higher than it would be if you claimed it now. So that's what he's in right now, the delay period. So Social Security hasn't started probably. Don't know if he has pensions, etc. That's what that means. Back to the email. This should last about 2 years and end when we fully turn on Social Security. So they're planning to turn on the Social Security at age 67, their full retirement age. In looking to minimize lifetime taxes, we plan on doing traditional IRA to Roth conversions up until RMDs begin. We hope to keep our RMDs from being overly burdensome, and we are planning, quote, for the one. Let me explain that, too. We look at tax planning through the eyes of your priority, and we've defined your priority as with two of you alive, so you're married filing jointly, one of you, so a survivorship scenario, or zero of you, we're giving priority for tax planning around the beneficiaries that are going to inherit your assets. So their priority area they're stating is the one. They're worried about the survivorship scenarios. The reason why oftentimes people are worried about that is that when the first of a couple dies, the survivor now has to file their income taxes as a single person, and the tax brackets compress, meaning all the income that oftentimes most of that income is retained for the surviving spouse, that income that the married couple would have to apply taxes using the married tax brackets are now being, that income is being shoved through the single brackets, and the taxes are a lot higher. So we often call that the widow-widower penalty or survivorship penalty, but they're worried about that. So in their calculations for the size of Roth conversions to do, they're paying attention, prioritizing that. Back to the email. So in mapping out how much to convert each year, I just realized that I had failed to consider how the special treatment of taxation on Social Security income might change the math. I live in a state that exempts Social Security from income tax, and I expect a 15% reduction on the federal side given our tax bracket. What he means by that is the fact that Social Security benefits, a maximum of 85% of those Social Security benefits are subjected to federal taxes depending on your income level. He continues, should this lead us to be less aggressive in conversions until our Social Security income starts and in effect shrinks our marginal tax rates? Thanks for my continuing education. Well, I don't know if you agree, Jake, but I think he got the word, it was when he said less aggressive, he meant or should have said more aggressive, because he's absolutely right. Once your Social Security turns on, there's a couple things going on. First, just there's more income that if any of your Social Security is subject to taxes, and that's going to depend on your level of what's called provisional income. There's calculators online that can help you with this. Doing it by hand is a pain beyond belief. There is a form you can download from Social Security that walks you through it by hand, but it's better to go to one of these online calculators where you can put in your Social Security benefits and your other income, and they'll tell you immediately what percentage of your Social Security income is going to be included in your taxable income. So once you start receiving Social Security, that's more income to be taxed and filling up those tax brackets that could otherwise be filled with Roth conversions. So generally, after you turn on your Social Security benefits, the amount of advisable Roth conversions declines because of this. And it's not just there's more taxable income. It's kind of a double whammy. And that's what he's talking about, the special rules around taxation. If your income level is low enough where you're not subject to 85% of your Social Security being subject to taxes, one of the unintended, not, I guess, unfortunate is a better word. One of the unfortunate side effects of doing a Roth conversion is not only will you owe taxes on the conversion, you also might be dragging more of your Social Security benefit into the taxable status when it maybe was not taxed before. I've got, just as an example, before I let you say anything here, Jake, if you've got, say, $37,000 of Social Security benefits, maybe between the two of you, and $40,000 of other income, which might be a Roth conversion, then 50% of your Social Security benefit is taxable. Only 50% of it is. But if I raise that other income to $50,000 from $40,000, now 73% of my Social Security is taxable. So let's say that extra $10,000 was the Roth conversion. Not only am I going to owe taxes on $10,000, I'm going to owe taxes on, let me get the number here.
An additional 8?
Hang on one second. I got the number.
9?
$8,000 of Social Security benefits that otherwise were not taxed. So it's almost like $8,000 of that $10,000 Roth conversion was double taxed. Effectively, that's what happens.
Right.
So yeah, this is something you should be paying attention to. And this is the reason why a lot of people fill aggressively, may or may not be the right word for your circumstances, because he didn't give us any numbers here. Right. Why maybe jumping on it and doing your Roth conversions before turning on Social Security is a good idea. And another reason why sometimes people delay past 67. I don't know the size of the RMDs you're trying to push down, but you might find it quite advisable to one or the other of you, or maybe both, delay past 67, giving you more than just 2 years to do Roth conversions without the Social Security benefits being part of the storyline at all. Give you a more opportunity to bring down those traditional IRA balances via conversions, getting you Roth dollars instead. That didn't affect that. Now, the other thing Roth conversions can do is affect your IRMA, if that's an issue too. That's not even a subject of this email, but there's, when contemplating a Roth conversion, there's a lot of moving parts, and it isn't just about the income tax. The conversation, I'd say, is dominated by that, but you need to be watching out for a few things. IRMA triggering, Social Security taxation implications, ACA premium tax credits that you might be giving up because you're doing Roth conversions and increasing your adjusted gross income. Those are the three biggies that we see. Maybe Jake has some other ones, but you should look at all those things. And that's why, you know, some of these calculators that look at all this, can make some sense.
Lots absolutely of moving parts. Chris. Cause the other thing is, if they're not looking at, like, I know the calculator you're talking about, if it's just like, here's the size of my IRA, you know, and here's my age or whatever, you know, what's the optimal path of conversions to choose to lower my lifetime in, you know, taxable income burden, you know, that doesn't take into consideration all those other things that Chris just mentioned, like IRMA, like Social Security taxability, like potentially the tax rate of long-term capital gains. You know, if you're, you know, trying to target some, keeping some gains at that 0% level, again, not knowing anything about this person, those are just some nice considerations that you should take into account, you know, this whole kind of picture before you decide to pull the trigger on this is the amount I convert.
Yeah.
And that's...
And there are calculators. A lot of them are mostly available to professionals, but there's some consumer-based ones where you can put in kind of hypothetical numbers and then, you know, include a few things in there that are kind of known numbers, maybe forced income. And once you're receiving Social Security benefits, that would be a form of what I call forced income. Mm-hmm. You can't choose to turn it on or off. It's just coming to you. And you include these things, and then you can get essentially an effective tax rate, an effective overall rate on the Roth conversion that, if the calculator is done correctly, could take into consideration some of these side effects. And then you look at that and say, you know, is that a good effective rate for me to be paying? And what you do is compare that to the effective rate when the RMDs have kicked in. And then that can give you some insight as to, should I be doing this, even though it's going to drag more of my Social Security in, or not? Because later on, when I'm receiving Social Security and I've got RMDs, almost certainly someone's going to be in the 85% of your Social Security is going to be taxable category, unless they have very little money. If you have any substantial savings at all, your RMDs are going to be big enough that piled with your Social Security, 80, you know, you're going to be in that. But early on, when you have some discretion or control over when you recognize income, that could matter, you know, in your math. And it's, you know, it can be a little tough if you got a lot of moving parts. The good news is if you've already blown through and you're definitely going to have 85% of your Social Security taxable, it actually makes the math easier because you don't have to worry about that. You've at least got one known there. But for those of you who are in that range where, you know, less than 85% of your Social Security is taxable, you need to be considering that the Roth conversion is going to drag more of those dollars of Social Security in, and those extra dollars that get drug in have the effect of making your Roth conversion twice as costly as it otherwise would be. And it might still make sense to do it, but maybe not. So I like the way this person's thinking, and he should definitely look into it. But it's his statement, should this lead us to be less aggressive in conversions until Social Security? No, these reasons lead you to be more aggressive in conversions before Social Security, because Social Security is likely to fill some of those attractive lower tax brackets more, leaving you less room in attractive brackets to do Roth conversions. So
couldn't agree more. That Social Security is just one. If you were to, you know, play it out like you put in the email, where you basically got 2 years without this extra income coming in, no, I would tend to be more aggressive. And you know, you don't have to worry about taxation of Social Security yet, so now you're just looking at the marginal tax rate and potential IRMA, depending on how much you're doing in conversion. So, and then making those trade-offs based on your entire situation, the size of your accounts, what future RMDs could be, et cetera.
Yeah. But, well, good set of emails, and thanks a lot for joining me, Jake. So we'll cut everybody loose here. We appreciate everybody for listening and appreciate everybody sending in questions. Again, I'll repeat that. So send in questions for the show, send them directly to Jim. His email's jim@jimhelps.com. That's jim@jimhelps.com. Put in the subject line that it's a question for the podcast, and then it's helpful if you include a word or two about the topic area that you're curious about. And these were all fairly recent emails. Sometimes they linger for a while. Sometimes we get to them right away. Like sometimes we don't get to them at all. If it's a question that we do regularly, your question, if you continue listening, will likely be answered, whether it's your email or not. Because anytime we get one that's a question we've never answered, we actually, that's exciting for us. And we usually get to it pretty quickly. So if we don't answer your specific question, it's probably because we either answer it regularly because it's a common question, or we've answered it recently from someone else's email. That's generally why it falls into the never answered bin, if you will. But thanks a lot. And Jake, take care. Everybody else.
Chris.
We'll be back with everybody next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio. read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.